You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, and shortly I will be sitting down here in the studio in the offices of Save the Children with the director Jez Stoner here in Colombia, that NGO which is widely known around the world, very, very effective in their projects all over the place. But of course, we'll be talking Colombia, and I feel like this episode 113 is a special episode. You know, 113 isn't a special number, it's not my lucky number or anything like that, but I feel it's a special episode because it's the first episode since September 23rd, when the FARC guerrillas and the government came to an agreement about how to wind down the conflict and sign a definitive peace accord 3 months from now. So that's 6 months from now. That's March 23rd. And 60 days from then, they will be handing in weapons. Now, let's just get this straight. There's no revolutionary group, guerrilla group in the world who will hand over their weapons to the government. What they will do is they will either destroy them or hide them somewhere in Colombian territory and possibly let the authorities, not the authorities, let an international body know where they are so they can be then collected or destroyed in that fashion. But it's massive. And I know there are naysayers, and I know there are people who are overwhelmingly positive, but this is a massive, massive historic agreement to have gotten this far, that the peace accords, the dialogues about which we've been talking here on Columbia Calling since the very beginning. They began in November 2012. They've been stagnated for over a year on the issue of justice, and now through a careful working on and wording of transitional justice, they have managed to reach an agreement of how we're going to move forward. Now, you know, there's still opportunity, if you're being incredibly negative, that this could all fall apart in the interim period, but let's keep our fingers crossed and hope that this doesn't happen. But to have got this far and to have a sitting president shaking hands in Havana with the commander-in-chief of the FARC guerrilla group, that's Timoleon Rodrigo Echeverri, is that not his name? Rodrigo Londoño Echeverri, something like that. Anyway, to have sat down with him, talked in private. Yes, of course, there are those who say that legitimizes the guerrilla group, legitimizes their politics, but then, you know, they've been a force for over 50 years. They've been fighting away, chipping away, and now, you know, were it not for the governments of Pastrana, Uribe, and Santos, we wouldn't be here today. You know, each one of those different presidencies had something to do with the way that we are now here. Whether you are right wing, whether you are left wing, there has been compromise, and this is important. So now we can start thinking about post-conflict and rehabilitation, reparation, and reconciliation here in Colombia. And then, of course, security sector reform, which needs to happen. And, you know, I will have a editorial out in the city paper in this coming month, in October, which I hope you will all read, because I talk about the difficulties of a post-conflict period, because there will be an increase in violence. There will be an increase in violence because not only will it increase actually and numerically, but also that it will feel like more, because the enthusiasm needs to be managed. The politicians need to manage our enthusiasm about a new normality, let's say. And so we're going to get morale sapping news that will undermine public support for these accords, but we've got to stick with it and keep going. So I'm going to take a short break, but we'll be back with Jez Stoner talking about Save the Children and their work here on the Pacific Coast. And of course, we'll be taking into account Wednesday's announcement about the possible peace accord between the FARC and the government. Huge news in Colombia. Of course, I love hearing from all of you. That's ColombiaCalling@gmail.com. That's ColombiaCallingRadio.com, the website, and of course, Twitter and Facebook too. You can find us. We've been getting emails suggesting people, and I've actually reached out to a few of them and had some replies. So this is all good news. That yes, keep them coming. Keep them coming. Let me know what you think. But don't go away. We'll be back with this fascinating interview with Jez Stoner, the director of Save the Children Colombia, right here on Colombia Calling. Thank you for listening.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota. Beautiful day down here in Palermo. I'm in the offices of Save the Children. It's a British NGO. You'll correct me because I'm here with the director for Colombia and the region, Jez Stoner, who's been based all over the world. He brings with him a wealth of experience from West Africa and, of course, Asia. He's based in Bangkok, but he's been here a few weeks now in Colombia. And we've, you know, based on Wednesday's announcement, last week's announcement, the landmark ruling and the signings of when the final agreement and the peace dialogues between the FARC and the government will come to. But we're here to talk about this and Save the Children's projects here in Colombia, because I know Save the Children. Of course, I know, I'm familiar with the logo. I'm from the UK myself, as you can, all of you out there know, my listeners, but of course my accent. But how well known is it here in Colombia? So it's an interesting one to sit down with Jez Stoner, and thank you for this time. So welcome on Colombia Calling.
Thanks very much indeed. Absolute pleasure. Well, in Colombia, Save the Children has been around since 1991. So okay. I think it's probably lived through and worked with children through some of the most complicated episodes, if you like, in Colombian history. But in terms of being a British NGO, Save the Children was actually founded in the UK in 1919, and it was founded by a woman called Glantine Jebb, and she set up Save the Children in response to basically a nutrition crisis at the end of the First World War, and organized food and shipments of aid to support starving refugees in Austria in the first instance. And so that's where it all began. But now there are Save the Children's all over the world, independent Save the Children's, okay, as well as a number of other Save the Children's which come under the banner of Save the Children International, as we are here in Colombia.
So interesting. So like the sort of autonomous networks for NGOs around the world as well, you sort of fall into the same categories. But great, you mean vast coverage across the world.
Yeah. At the moment, Save the Children has a presence in something in the order of 120 countries around the world, which is a vast presence in the great scheme of things.
It is a great scheme. I'm trying to think how many countries there are, and I don't want anyone to test me on that. But fantastic. But you've been here a few weeks, and you've come in, let's say, from experience in Senegal, experience in Asia. In these few weeks that you've been here, let's hear a little bit of the situation in Colombia, how you've come into it here, and saying, you know, what needs to be done, what is Save the Children doing?
Mm. Okay. Yeah. No. Good question. I think in the 4 weeks that I've been here, I mean, obviously, for me, having worked at Save the Children for such a long time, for me, the most important thing I would guess is actually what happened last Wednesday, and I couldn't be here, I don't think, at a more important time historically, and the reason why that's so important and why peace processes and peace indeed in every part of the world where there is armed conflict is so important it's actually at the end of the day it's children on the ground who suffer most through those times. And in Colombia we're talking about conflict which has endured for 50 years or so, and clearly I've never actually been working in a country, even in sub-Saharan Africa or elsewhere, that's had a conflict that has run for so many years, and so this sort of historic moment is the thing that gives me the most sort of hope and for the future, basically, here in Colombia, and I think it actually sends a huge message across the whole country, whether it's areas controlled by criminal gangs, whether it's areas controlled by FARC rebels, etc., that actually here we are at a historical moment, which actually we can really, really change things over the coming 6 months.
I think that's it. I mean, you know, that announcement came out of Havana, and there was, I mean, Timochenko, Rodrigo Echeverri, Londoño Echeverri, and President Juan Manuel Santos, and to see them together. And I knew that the naysayers would get up and immediately say that legitimizes them. That is, but we've been in this situation now where they've been in the dialogue since November 2012. There has already been a level of legitimization of the situation. Now we need to take the next step. And rightly so, people are saying over the airwaves, I've been listening all this week, you know, the dates, that they've put a final date, March 2016, I guess March 23rd, 2016, and then from that, a 60-day limit for the FARC to, I don't think they'll be handing in their weapons, but sort of, I kind of liken it to an IRA thing. It's probably just hide them somewhere off and then alert an international observer to where they are, maybe. But, I mean, it's just phenomenal. And like you say, it's the children on the ground. It's the subsequent generations, because there are generations, and I'm talking to my wife, who's Colombian, of course, her parents have never known peace, you know, even, you know, that she's never known peace. And so we have to grasp at this, you know, with the hope. So how is Save the Children going to get fully involved, let's say in this situation?
Well, I think one of the ways that we in a sense are all already involved is through our education work. We have a pretty large portfolio of education work supported by the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade of the Canadian government, and they've been supporting Ahsoka Children's work here for some time. And we work I've been here such a short time, but we work in a part of Colombia out of Guapi and elsewhere on the Pacific coast. And having initiated my time in Colombia in a very nice neighbourhood here in Bogota, the contrast going to the town of Guapi on the Pacific coast, which is this small town of about 2,000 people, but one of the larger towns along that coast. The contrast, it's almost like another world, to be quite honest, and I can't remember seeing such huge contrasts before. Having worked in various places in Africa and elsewhere, quite often if you live in a capital city or a major town in Africa, the contrasts are not necessarily so great between the two. But arriving in Guapi, and the first thing you notice, of course, is an almost total lack of infrastructure. There simply isn't any. So that's one thing. The second thing that is very, very clear, and which I'm fortunate not to have experienced in Bogota, and Bogota has improved immeasurably since the first time I visited in 1993, is the fact that in all of the communities where we work, they are afflicted day in, day out by violence and threats of violence. And this has a huge impact on the children and other members of the communities there. So you have this complete lack of infrastructure, you have a hugely violent context, and then you also have this sort of, again, I'm not that familiar with Colombia, but you go into the Pacific Coast area, and what are the options for young people there? I mean, okay, there's a bit of fishing, but again, there are issues around fishing stocks, etc. There's a bit of illegal mining. Some of it, increasingly, there's some legal mining opportunities, but again, that's very, very precarious and often very dangerous. And so thirdly, there's joining, if you like, criminal gangs and or rebel groups. And we're talking about children who have actually been recruited into armed groups. And there are also opportunities, clearly, if you want to be part of the drugs trade, which is present in that area, including things like sort of the, I'm not wholly familiar with it, but you know, it's playing a part in the part of the manufacturing process towards pure cocaine for export to other parts of the world and Latin America. And so there's really, really limited opportunities, and And around those opportunities is the constant threat of violence. And so what we've been doing, I think, I would classify, if you like, all of the ingredients of what I saw and of the young people and teachers and others that I spoke to. I mean, it really is a sort of an ongoing horrendous, if you like, sort of humanitarian nightmare for so many of those communities who are often on the move, often forced to move late at night, abandoned their homes, children don't know where they're going, parents have abandoned some of their children who've gone off to join military groups, etc. And within that context, we've been providing through with Save the Children and the local education authorities, and also another organisation called the Norwegian Refugee Council. I think it's really, really critical to work with people, other people who've got, and other organisations that've got really strong experience. So in that context, what we do is the Norwegian Refugee Council, they look for and identify children who are out of school and help them to get back into school. And what we do is actually focus on the schools themselves to provide a really high quality education for those children, which actually quite often have fallen off the edge of the map, to be quite honest. Mm-hmm. And there's been so little investment, and that's part of this shock I had with the infrastructure. There's just nothing there. Mm-hmm. And the only way that people to get around is through through the local waterways and rivers, etc. And you know, you see children rowing little wooden boats for an hour and a half to get to school. I mean, it's quite staggering. So my first impressions was this sort of place that's a completely another world and really under-resourced, if you like. And then juxtaposed with that, providing some real stability at school level to for training teachers, identifying what the most important things are for children in that context, and providing what the Ministry of Education says needs to be provided to all children in Colombia, and for the first time actually giving these children the opportunity to do that. The other thing that is very, very clear from that part of the coast, it's almost entirely made up of Afro-Colombians. And it's a very interesting, exciting community. I think a community, one of the community leaders at a meeting that I was at stood up and said, one of the things that people from the outside have always got to understand about us is that we are really up for doing joint initiatives together, working together to really start to address some of our problems. And so, you know, we've been emphasising in terms of the sort of the quality education piece, bringing communities and parents into the school to help make decisions about their children's education. But not only that, in the case of Afro-Colombians, some of the most incredible sort of extracurricular stuff that we've been supporting is actually using traditional instruments, getting children singing, playing instruments, reconnecting with their roots, if you like. I mean, it's just absolutely fascinating. And so for me, I just see these sort of incredible oasis of stability in the middle of some of the remotest and hardest to get places where actually children are receiving a really fantastic education. And that, for me, is powerful and very exciting.
Very, very interesting, very informative, and again, highlighting this issue that we have in Colombia that's so prevalent. Is, of course, like you mentioned, it's the rural and the urban Colombia, the as you say, yeah, the differences, the yeah, disparity between the two. I mean, and I just want to pick up this. It sounds to me like the Norwegian Refugee Council is kind of like the truant officer, you know, going around checking out the children, and you guys are in the schools itself. But fascinating to hear your thoughts on Guapi. It was one of the first places I actually got to visit when I was sent out with WWF, mm-hmm, and within 24 hours of leaving Godalming in Surrey, where WWF has their office, a very, you know, quite well-heeled part of the UK. 24 hours later, I was in Guapi eating fish head soup, which was, needless to say, it was a change, less. But very, really interesting, very, you know, you're hitting it on the head, is that what are the opportunities for the young people out there? I'm doing some work at the moment, but further north, sort of scripting for a documentary about the Pacific, and part of it is, you know, okay, so there's fishing, yes, there's music, but it's more in the south, like as you mentioned with the marimba and the kurulau music, which is amazing, and then you, and But the thing that has struck me is that someone, you know, did inform me, he's like, no, you've got to get La Minga, you know, so where they work together, mm-hmm. where it's a community, a collective, collaborative effort. Yep. Where they and this week they're doing one in Nuki, which is it's just a huge refuse collection. And everyone's coming and everyone's bringing food, and it will be almost like a family reunion, because it's all family, you know, there's all family. So fascinating to see this in a different cultural identity to the rest of Colombia, and that's the truth of it. I'm fascinated with your descriptions and what you have to share with us, Jez Stoner, and I'd like to thank you. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with the next segment of this show to talk further about the issues here in Colombia and what Save the Children is doing. So this is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McColl. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McColl, and we're here talking to the director of Save the Children Colombia, Jez Stoner, and we're having a fascinating conversation about the Pacific Coast. As many of you out there will remember from previous shows, I am passionate about the Pacific Coast, having been there with WWF from the late 90s, early 2000s, and I was meant I had to travel up and down the coast from Tumaco, Buenaventura, and various towns in between, including Guapi, about which you spoke, in a canoe, a motorized canoe, and we stayed in, with the photographer, we stayed in various communities. I can't even remember their names. When you do an internet search, it just turns up like a Médecins Sans Frontières report about malaria outbreaks or dengue or other things, and we had to do studies on the piangueras, so the people who get out there, and, you know, from very young age and to very advanced age as well, in this thick mud of the mangrove swamps, reaching down into the roots, braving the snakes and other critters that are found in there. Many of the people I met had paralysis in their hands from this. And the piangues are a type of clam. And the only real difference to the sort of clam that you and I might know from Europe is that it's back-breaking hard work and on the mangroves. And so that was my first real experience of out there. And like I say, you know, 24 hours after leaving London and Godalming and Surrey, I was in Guapi, which is a kind of extreme, to say the least. But I want to talk about a few things that you mentioned in the previous segment, and you said, you know, the limited opportunities. We are aware of this. I mean, the Pacific Coast, you look at it on the map, and you look at this relief map of Colombia and the mountain ranges, and then, of course, the waterways. I mean, it's the wettest place on Earth. It's impossible. It's an impossible thing. And there's been, I mean, I wouldn't even say 0% investment, because investment has been limited at best in the region. There is no sort of direct means of communication to most of the towns. Of course, Tumaco and Buenaventura both have roads to them, but they're both ports. And so there is a financial incentive for central government in Bogota to maintain that. But then we know the statistics, and it's come up in The Economist on various occasions, that a container from China to Buenaventura, shipping it costs less than what it takes from Buenaventura to Bogota. So that gives you a bit of an idea of the geography of Colombia. But, you know, you say Guapi, 2,000 people, limited opportunities. You've got the newly emerged criminal gangs, which are sort of the offshoot of paramilitaries, or called backroom here, or just drugs. You've got the guerrilla groups. You've got a bit of fishing, but like you say, Guapi, of course, was what was a gateway to Gorgona, which was seen as a great hope for the area, the former prison island, which, you know, lots of snakes on there as well, but, you know, sort of run by Aviator until recently, when there was a FARC guerrilla attack there. And so I guess less and less people, even of the trickle that was going through, is even less now. Even with Wednesday's announcements and the positive nature of these things, you think it's almost a bottomless pit that has to be filled before we, you know, the impossibility of filling a bottomless pit of investment and communication. But I want to talk about the children, because of course we talk about opportunities, but so when we talk about children getting sort of roped up in these nefarious other illicit industries, from what age are you finding in your experience?
I mean, it obviously varies, but certainly early teenagers have been involved clearly in armed groups, and this is something which is not exclusive to Colombia.
Yeah.
Having worked recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo, again, child soldiers and child armed combatants is a very, very common occurrence in much of certainly eastern Congo. And again, here it's also a big issue. But I think that one of the most sort of, I don't know, it's so tragic. If you think of a 12 or a 13 year old getting recruited into or forcibly joining into an armed group, quite often what happens as a result of that is their parents actually reject that child. And even if they were able to get out of that situation, returning home is not an easy or necessarily an option at all. Mm-hmm. And I was speaking to with one of the teachers, one of the young girls in one of the schools, and she was talking about how she almost talking about her brother in the past tense, because he'd gone off to or been recruited into an armed group, and that she only had her sister left. And that, you know, that kind of a thing is just so horrendous. And you know, children of 12 years old or 11 years old can start pretty young. The place where they need to be is with their mates and friends, mm-hmm. Playing in their villages and communities, and also at school during the day, and having, you know, access to something that will really give them, you know, the opportunity. Because we've talked about Guapi, and we've talked about that coastal area as having such little, if you like, realistic and, if in a sense, honest opportunity for so many children. But at least through the medium of education, you're providing some level of hope for some of those children to go on and find, you know, decent opportunities. But I think one of the things that you've mentioned quite a lot is that I think that, you know, we're really excited, and I think we're all passionate about what happened last Wednesday, and you know, that just the inkling, just the twinkle on the horizon of peace in a country like Colombia has to be the most sort of motivating thing for everybody, whether you're Colombian or whether you're from anywhere else in the world, to be quite honest, because I think everyone's had enough of this after 50 years. But on the ground at the moment, children are living this reality of the opposite of peace, which is an armed conflict, which is insidious.
Do we think this thing about, you know, the rejection by the families, that this has been an active, sort of, let's say, portion of educational practice here in Colombia, sort of saying, oh, you know, you've joined a gang, a group, an armed group, that's it. They're no longer your families. Over time, this has become the norm. That's how it's sort of just always been addressed. Though, is this not, because if you're working in education, this is something you're going to have to get past, surely. You know, you have to repair this.
No, that's absolutely right. And actually talking about repairing huge amounts of damage, because the psychological damage on a family, let alone the child that's gone off to be part of an armed group, is tremendous. But, you know, I think that, you know, when we're going back to the whole peace process, we're going to be looking at former combatants. They'll have to have a lot of psychological support to actually reintegrate back into different parts of Colombian society. But similarly with children, there's an absolute work to be done, both with the child themselves, but also with their families, because actually the important place for children to be, if they're still, you know, under 18, is to be back with their families. And it's actually looking at the kinds of support you can provide to bring those to bring those families together.
Is this a reality that could happen in Colombia? I'm just taking an example that's a bit left field in this one, but I have a friend who's a, you know, forensic anthropologist. Mm-hmm. And she's sent out to do some of the most insanely awful jobs in mass graves in Caquetá and wherever. And I was asking her, but do you guys have, you know, psychological treatment? Do you sit down with psychologists afterwards, and do they just unwind you? Oh, there's none of that. Mm-hmm. None of that whatsoever. I said, well, how do you deal with that? And so, well, we just deal with it in our own personal ways. But there has to be a recognition of the scarring that goes on. I mean, she lives in a nice part of Bogota, is incredibly well educated, has, you know, her family looks after her, etc., etc. But it's not normal to see these things, you know. It's not. So I just wonder, I being slightly negative, is Colombia ready to put, you know, it's money where the mouth is in terms of psychologists? We really need hundreds if not thousands for the amount of people that have been damaged over 50, 52, 55 years.
Yeah, in the short time that I've been here, so that's a really tough question in a sense. I mean, I think that on one level, obviously, the role of psychologists and others who are specialists, if you like, in dealing with mental health issues and all of the other stuff will be absolutely fundamental in the coming months and years. But I think on the other hand, there are examples at local level where the community's got together to actually work with young people and work with families who've been, if you like, scarred and literally wounded by the conflict. And I think that there are things that you can do in order to start to repair some of that damage. And going back to this issue of the schools,
yes,
and providing stability and opportunity in those schools, I think it's been an incredible sort of anchor for communities who've been used to actually running around and being threatened constantly. And so I think that that's one actually really important component. So you've always got that opportunity. And one of the other things that we've been doing here is that when there's been large displacements of children due to conflict and communities, we've actually been supporting those children when they've gone to other remote areas that where they've left their homes and stuff, actually supporting them with education on the move, as it were, so that they don't miss out. And they there's a certain degree of sort of, if you like, continuity in their lives, because otherwise you're basically not going to get anywhere. And it's absolutely fundamental that they have, if you like, a safe space, even if they've been abandoned their homes at midnight the night before, but within, you know, a couple of days, getting them back to some sense of reality and normality of studying, but also being together with other children to actually, if you like, enjoy being a child and enjoy having the offer of some sense of stability when it's chaotic all around them.
That is phenomenal. So if you think about, let's say a small community in the Pacific, on the Pacific coast, that's displaced due to violence, but you'll have teams that will then help them.
That's right.
Create, let's say, it's a stability, because what do children need more? Like you're saying, there's continuity, there's stability, and of course then the parents are seeing that you're not abandoning them in a time of need as well, which
that's
is
right.
a
that's
huge right. Confidence boost.
Yeah.
So you've got the trust.
That's right.
That's fantastic.
Right? But, I think it's incredibly important. The other reason why this has been important, and I think it's now recognised as a really important humanitarian response. If you think about humanitarian responses, traditionally it's about food, it's about water, it's about having a roof or a plastic sheet over your head, etc., etc., etc. And quite often, when communities have been displaced historically, children can actually go for years without having access to education because they've been moved from one place to another, etc. But providing that continuity is a response that's absolutely required when children get displaced. One of the things I think that I think is interesting, and I think it's interesting, shocking, and everything else that you can throw at it, is that also we're quite often focused on girls, if you like, entering into armed combat, on boys rather, sorry, entering armed combatant groups, and I do think that there are some real issues for girls on the ground in some of the most insecure parts of Colombia, and we've got to talk about it because it's happening day in and day out. But girls are also, you know, the victim of rape and sexual exploitation to degrees that are unthinkable in some parts of Colombia, and so there's definitely a very, very strong, if you like, gender dimension to criminal gangs, to the armed groups, etc. And this is something which really, really is quite horrendous. And again, the kinds of sort of specialist support those girls need is something that really will have to be dealt with in a major way, because that's absolutely critical.
But this is being addressed, though. I mean, there are projects in process, would you say? I mean, I know that there's a report coming out later in the year being done by Lawyers Without Borders. Again, I funded in part by the Canadian Overseas Aid, and it will be about sexual violence. And of course, that was mentioned on Wednesday as well as being one of the crimes against humanity that guerrilla members will not you know, they will be held accountable for it. You know, it's 5 years minimum, 8 years maximum, depending on what they've done, and if they don't admit it, 20 years. But these are the things that really need to be brought up, to brought to light, because I don't think a lot of people know a lot about that, you know, this the gender division, the dimension of the abuse and the violation that has gone on and continues to go on. It's in, you know, that's a reality.
Absolutely, no, that's absolutely right. And I think, interestingly enough as well, if we go back to Bogota level, we go back to the Ministry of Education, we look at education policies at a national level here in Colombia, actually there's some pretty strong emphasis in terms of the policy framework on gender being an integral part of the curriculum. And again, one of the things that really sort of opened my eyes when I went to Guapi was that we've been working very closely with heads of schools and teachers and also students themselves on issues around gender. Mm-hmm. And we had the sort of a fairly open session in one of the schools. And we're talking about groups of children between about sort of 12, 13, 14 of that age. But actually, we start to talk about, introduce issues of gender as young as seven now in schools around Guapi. And this has just never been there before. And for the first time, both boys and girls are talking about, if you like, the differences between boys and girls, but also the real questions that they have about their own sort of, if you like, identity and what it means to be a boy and a girl. And there's this fascinating book that was passed around by one of the head teacher in the school where they actually did a questionnaire to all the students and said, well, look, what are the things that you worry about, for example, when talking about things like sex? Some of the children who were in the school who had been recently come into the school actually can't read and write. Mm-hmm. And these are the children that have been out of school. We've got them back into the school system. And so they were drawing various drawings in the book to express some of the questions they had. And then other kids had actually written down stuff. But again, for the first time, I mean, there are taboos in Guapi. And so talking about sex and sexuality is just simply something that in many communities just isn't done. Full stop. And in many parents, as in other parts of the world, you know, are reluctant or uncomfortable about talking about sex with children and stuff like that. But here, you know, there was one big taboo. For example, one of the big issues in and around Guapi and along the coast is teenage pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So that's a big deal, as it actually is in the UK, where I come from, compared to other European countries. And here that's a big issue. And so there's, you know, children having sessions about, you know, if you have sex just before you menstruate, then there's no chance of getting pregnant. So all of these kinds of myths, if you like, that are around, for the first time are being talked about. And these are the kinds of things that will start to address things like teenage pregnancy, etc. But actually, more importantly than that, I think that bringing parents and teachers into the discussion, again, many times for the first time, but with the tools, using experts to support them, with the tools to let them talk about these things, issues not just about the horrendous things we've already talked about girls and the consequence of armed conflicts and rape, etc., but also starting to highlight some of the issues of abuse within families, and those things starting to emerge and starting to be talked about for the first time, and school being a safe place in which perhaps you can talk to your teacher about it. And again, so bringing these things, which are part of the curriculum, but haven't actually been, if you like, fully integrated into very remote parts of the country like Guapi and with the Afro-Colombian community there, you know, it's just a real eye-opener to see this stuff starting to be talked about and seeing young girls, young boys talking about gender issues in the school. It's quite remarkable. And, you know, a few years ago, there would have been absolutely nothing in place there at all for children to even have the confidence to speak to their teachers and or their peers about it.
Massive steps.
Very exciting.
Massive steps. Amazing, amazing jobs. Now, I just thought, I've got a question again at this point, because it's something else we mentioned, and it's about the former combatants. You know, so you're dealing with a lot of former combatants, and in particular children, and a lot, you know, are abandoned, let's say, or shunned by their families, so they end up in the cities like Bogota. Do you do a following? Do you follow up and see whether, you know, if the children of, you know, let's say, problems in Guapi have ended up in Soacha or places like that in Bogota? Do you have projects here in Bogota that follow up on the former combatants or?
No, what we're actually mainly focused on in places like Guapi is actually basically former combatants here in Colombia go through a process where they're actually effectively institutionalized mm-hmm. by government authorities. So there's a whole series of authorities who are providing support to those children, but quite often for up to 6 months yeah. In particular residential let's call them homes, but in residential homes where they are being looked after and they are being provided with support, etc. And then it's from those residential homes that they're then, if you like, prepared to go back into their communities and go back with their families.
Okay.
So we actually work with children who are leaving that system, if you like, after and then working with them and the families and communities.
Excellent.
Having said that, I think one of the really important things is that I think that for most, I think for a number of observers, I think would say that, you know, 6 months is quite a long time to keep a child who's been part of a combatant group under very close supervision, if you like, and you know, I think we'd be really happy to look at some of the issues of that length of time and to look more at bringing children out of that in back into the family and community context a little bit more quickly, but with the adequate support which goes with that, and that requires professionals like social workers, in the absence, if you like, of a huge stock of psychiatrists, etc. But social workers actually can provide quite a lot of the things that are required to support those children going back into their families. So we're looking now that there's a real this wonderful prospect on the horizon of peace. We're now looking at the whole system of children who are, if you like, leaving the armed forces, being supported by many excellent professionals within the Colombian apparatus, if you like, for support, and then looking at how we can help support those children transitioning from there back into their families. So this whole area of protection of children, not just boys but girls as well, but of ex-combatants, is something that is absolutely the heart of our work. So we've just finished, I think, planning for the next period, 2016 to 2018, a sort of strategic period for Save the Children here in Colombia. And we've put protection right at the centre of that. And quite often when you do strategic documents, you may get things slightly awry because the context changes so quickly.
Yes.
But in this case, having protection absolutely the centre of what we're going to do, which is focusing on child combatants, focusing on gender issues, focusing on girls who've been the victims and boys who've been the victims of abuse, is something that's going to be central. And that mm-hmm. coincides really perfectly with the, is it the 23rd of March 2016, when we really hope to see that peace agreement signed. It won't mean that peace breaks out everywhere in Colombia within the next day of the signing, but it will provide so much hope to communities across the entire nation, and that's the critical part, I think.
That is it, isn't it? Isn't it? You know, that signing, it's the relevance, it's the significance, and we know from other issues and conflicts around the world that, unfortunately, violence increases once a peace yeah. accord's been signed, yeah. because you have, you know, a whole number of people not knowing what to do, and exactly. and they're trained in something else.
Exactly.
But let's not digress on that point. But that's the truth of it. So for those listeners out there, it's been fascinating, Jez. I'd like to say thank you, because I think you've been so informative and so open about Save the Children's work here. It really is. You know, it fills me with confidence that we're doing the right things, that you guys, you know, education, you know, getting the next generation, subsequent generations, you know, in the right place, let's say, mm-hmm. mentally, exactly. Psychologically, and of course physically as well, you know, it's mm-hmm. all. So let me just take this moment and say thank you very much, Jess Stoner,
thank
for
you.
Being on the show. yeah, I hope to hear from some of you out there. You know, I always like getting your emails and tweets and messages on Facebook. Of course, you can get in touch at columbiacalling@gmail.com, columbiacallingradio.com, Facebook, Twitter, etc., etc., all the other social media evils that we have. But it's been a really, really fascinating interview to have this week in the light of Wednesday's announcements about the 23rd of March 2016. I know that Jez Stoner and I are incredibly confident and hopeful of a positive outcome of the next 6 months, and then the further 60 days as well, of course, the handing in of weapons. So this has been Columbia Calling. I've been Richard McColl talking to Jez Stoner of Save the Children. Thank you for listening.